Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 53, titled Universal Militarism versus Demilitarized Society.
So now we come to Tibet. And this was fully counted. We come to Tibet. And Tibet receives all this in one lump from these great yogis. It starts in the 7th century. Oh, it's a little earlier than the 7th century. 6th century by magical means, but 7th century in earnest. But the one king, when one king conquers the whole plateau, basically, and unifies the country. And once he does, he turns to India to create a society that is viable without conquering further. Because, you know, conquest societies that we're discovering in America is really boring. It's totally boring. You know, because you go around beating people up, and then when people are home between the battle, they're all like Rambo. They don't know how to stop beating people up. And it's like really terrible. So he doesn't want to continue that. And so it's a top-down thing at the beginning. Like at the time of Ashoka in India, you could say, which is to say that the emperor of Tibet makes people become Buddhist. He imports it. He sends a guy to India to make an alphabet for Tibet that will fit with Sanskrit, bases it on Sanskrit, creates a grammatical system that fits with Sanskrit, so he can translate all the Buddhist sutras. Of course, the Buddhists think that king is an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, who is their Jesus, you can say, their Messiah figure. You know, the Buddhists was, you know, Kuan Yin in China, or Canon in Japan, Avalokiteshvara in India, Chenrezig in Tibet. They have this thousand-armed, you know, deity. Well, he has many forms, but one of them is has thousand arms, meaning reaching into all kind of beings' lives with compassion. He has an eye in the palm of each of the thousand hands, which means that he sees with wisdom what beings need. He doesn't just interfere in their lives. And, you know, the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa, both of them, those two over in those paintings, they are both considered living incarnations of the Avalokiteshvara. So the Buddhist culture, the Tibetan Buddhist culture, is a culture where the Jesus figure keeps coming back. Remember Jesus said, I'll come back within this generation or something, I'll be back? Or in Schwarzeneggerese, I'll be back. But then he doesn't show up, and then those people in Texas are just waiting for some really ridiculous thing of somebody coming and killing everybody who's not Christian, which is horrible. But originally, Jesus may well have meant, because people don't actually know that, but the rabbis told me, they still have that. That is, in the Mediterranean in Jesus' time, reincarnation was commonly accepted. It was the common doctrine, it was common sense. Like it is in a Buddhist culture, or Taoist, or Hindu culture. It's like normal. It isn't like a mysterious thing. You know, nihilism is a mysterious thing. That you know, in a world of the second law of thermodynamics, where no energy is ever destroyed, no energy is beginningless, no energy is ever created out of nothing, and it's never destroyed, never can become nothing. In that kind of world, why is the energy of the personal consciousness the one thing that's destroyed? It's ridiculous. It's very mysterious. And as I said, based on blind faith, because no one ever found it to be destroyed. They just didn't find something. If you know, when you look for something and don't find it, you don't find nothing, except as a manner of speech. You just don't find what you were looking for. So the point is that this is common sense. Even in Jesus' time, that was common sense. So be within this generation. So there, like those two guys are two alternative Jesus forms, in the sense that, and that's another thing that's preposterous or completely inconceivable to Westerners, what's called the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha. If you, when you become a Buddha, you will have what's called a Nirmanakaya. A Nirmanakaya means emanation bodies, plural. And that means you can emanate whatever you want. But you don't want anything for yourself, but if some being needs someone to interact with them in some way, or a place, or an object, or whatever, you manifest as that, yourself. And so the idea, for example, the Buddhists, you know, I've had interreligious dialogues, and Buddhists have this, and they talk to some Lutheran or something, and they say, "How many children do you have?" And the guy says, "5. And they say, "But your omnipotent God only can have one?" And then they get a lot of theology. And then they go back and forth on like that, and finally they just give up. But the idea that the all-powerful force of love and compassion, and in the case of a theist, monotheistic religion where they think the God is even the creator of everything, the idea that they would be limited to create only this thing only for the few Christians, it's just inconceivable to a Buddhist, with the idea of the emanation body where Buddha, who's not even a creator, but is immensely competent and creative within the situation that we all have created with our mutual evolutionary actions, that Buddha would only manifest in one place at one time to one bunch of people is inconceivable. And therefore the Tibetan culture, where there are many emanations of the universal compassion of all Buddhas, is like a normal for a main, it's a mainstreaming of the Mahayana Buddhist culture. India never quite managed that level of mainstreaming because the Vedist caste system, Brahminical culture, was never completely uprooted. Buddhism didn't try to uproot it, but it did try to modify it and to moderate it, and it did do so, actually. And like Hinduism, for example, vegetarianism in Hinduism, nonviolence, ahimsa, Gandhi, thinking of it as a Hindu thing. These are imports from Buddhism and Jainism, from what are called the ascetical or the seeker traditions, not from the Vedas tradition, although modern Indians think it all comes from the Vedas. But the Vedas are war songs, mostly, actually, and ritual songs, and they had animal sacrifices in the rituals and things like that, the Vedas thing, which would horrify any but the very small percentage of Hindu Kali worshippers, you know. And so I'll come to this. So anyway, this is what came in the time of the kings. And the kings brought this in, and they brought it in, and the Tibetans think historically, therefore, this king was, Songtsen Gampo was the name of the first great, what they call Dharma king, who brought the Buddhism in a big way into Tibet. But he didn't even build a monastery, actually, at the time. He had some monks visiting. He sent people to India to study with them. He started introducing texts and doctrines and things. But he didn't actually, but people remained mostly laity. The difficult thing to do in a militarized society, in a society concentrated on producing wealth, victory, triumph, status, people rising in status through being successful warriors and so on. That kind of society doesn't go for monasticism, it's difficult to put. So even that first king did not manage to build a single monastery. But he did get the nobles to get into it, and people got into it, and then Buddhism has something at every level. For the women, it has their own access to education and their own idea that they can be equal with the men and become equally enlightened as individuals, you know, and their sort of role, gender-determined role. The society doesn't have, and in a warrior society, it's always not that good because, you know, violence is the key element in such a society. And so they had something. The peasants, the poor people, they had the idea of future life in the pure land, and the Buddha was there for every single ordinary person. And then even the king, the nobles had the idea that the king was elected in a way, was the first among equals and wasn't some kind of divine right emperor who could kill all of them. But was as long as he served as the you know, helper of the people, he had a right to be the king. And so, you know, there's later on when Buddhism went to China, there's a wonderful book by a Dutch scholar named Eric Zurcher called The Buddhist Conquest of China, which shows how Buddhism had something for everybody, and it was only resisted by some Confucian ministers who were at the time afraid of monasticism, that it would take wealth out of the king's treasury and it would lessen the king's military power, which in fact it did. Monasticism. I was a monk, for example, but I against the wishes of my original mentor, teacher, but he took me to Dalai Lama and said, "This boy wants to be a monk, and he's really smart, and he speaks Tibetan, and he loves Buddhism, and he really loves it, but he shouldn't be, and he sincerely wants to be a monk for life. He wants to be a monk for life. He's not faking. But he doesn't know his future, and he won't be able to stay a monk, and that's not the Tibetan thing. So don't make him a monk is my advice, and I refuse to make him a monk," my original mentor said. "But you're the Dalai Lama, you decide." But then the Dalai Lama did make me a monk, and then I didn't stay. He was mad at me for a while. Because there's no monks here. We don't have monks. There's no American Buddhist monks. All the Buddhist Dharma centers here are owned by ex-monks. And they're not about to bring in monks to be superior to them, because there's a status thing where the layperson respects the monk. Even if the layperson is more knowledgeable than the monk, still respects that monk. And they can't be bossed around by your lay Dharma community head. And that's guys don't like that. And then therefore they come up with all these theories about modern Buddhism doesn't need monks and nuns, this and that. Like, which they don't realize is the Protestant cultural ethos of this country. No free lunch. You know, you're not going to support someone just to seek their liberation. You know, and then what is the outcome of the Protestant ethic and the destruction of European monasticism? May I ask you what it is? What is it? Oh, it's the Great Industrial Revolution. Oh, gee, it's wonderful modern this and that technology. Oh, yeah, great. Protestant ethic. Okay, Carnegie, Rockefeller. Wonderful. But what else is it? It is universal militarism is what it is. There's no place for those young aggressive males to go to like beat their heads against a wall instead of beating other people's heads against the wall. To conquer their inner enemy, their greed, hatred, delusion. There's no place. It's not respected. Yeah, there's some dropouts who go to Zen Center and do that. You know, but even that Zen Center, they don't become monks there. The Zen monks all have girlfriends. And I'm a monk. I say, "Guys, you're not monks. You're priests. You're like ministers. But monk means celibate. You can't be monks." I remember Dido Laurie and I used to have this discussion a lot. You know? But they won't respect a monk because that's the Protestant ethos of our culture. But then after I quit being a monk, at first I sort of flirted with all the Dharma Center leaders going around saying, "We don't need monks. You know, we learn in the family, we learn with our children, we're learning, like we don't need to be monks." And I followed that a little bit. But then one day, it was in a lecture by a sociologist at Columbia, although I hadn't come to Columbia yet, named Seymour Melman. And I was with a group who were like, you know, peaceniks, you know, and denuclearization, nuclear freeze demonstration sort of thing. And he gave a lecture and he said, "It's great you guys are protesting, maybe they'll, you know, go down and put flowers." You know, the hippies went down and put flowers in the guns of the guards at the Pentagon. It was really great. You all did that. It was wonderful. But you know what? You guys are amateurs. There's no peace movement jobs. You go back to your day job after trying to say we must have peace. Before the Iraq war, second invasion, the completely criminal invasion of Iraq, before that invasion, millions of people all over the world protested and demonstrated, but they had to go back to their day jobs. And this guy Melman said, "Now the war industry people, they have day jobs. They make a lot of money. They may stop one day and take a day off when you're surrounding their Pentagon or whatever they, or their factory or their missile factory. But then you have to go to your job, and then they will go back to their job and make more missiles and make more plans for more wars. Because it's a profession. And you don't have a profession." And that really stumped me, that one. He was saying that, you know, just as a father, you know, as a citizen of this country. And then I realized, of course, the institutional opposition in history to militarism, the only effective one is monasticism. Now, just using the term, just generally. And it was mainly Buddhist and Christian. Hindus didn't have monks until around 800-900 of the Common Era. And Muslims still don't have them. They have Sufi orders, but they're all married. So they don't really have monks. And Taoists do, and Buddhists do, and Jains do, and Catholics do, you know, and Orthodox, you know, Christians. And the monastic institution are like, therefore, the inversion of the warriors. And, you know, that the militancy of the warrior is inverted and introverted, and then the person battles with their own inner demon, which is their selfishness and their anger and their greed and all this sort of thing. And they can win that battle. And then when they do, they become, when they do in a large community, they become like a group they become like a peace army in a society. And therefore, in history, they impact. And if you look at the history of Tibet, around 640, the first important Tibetan temple was built. And first important Tibetan temple was built. I don't know, these computers are annoying. And in that temple was built by the king, and they started making Buddha into sort of like their trans-deity deity. And after that,1640, the Dalai Lama was made the ruler of Tibet by a Mongolian warlord. And then all Tibetan warlords, which had been flourishing, of course, still flourishing, but slowly freaking out about it, about the fact of so much manpower going into, and so much wealth and so much land, you know, stocks in such a society are land, you know, like the equivalent of stocks and bonds are land, because they agricultural, they produce, you know, food and herbs and other things. And so when 1,000 years, a culture that produced a huge conquest of all its neighbors and had an enormous empire, the Tibetan Empire. They conquered the Silk Road, they conquered Tang Dynasty China, the main capital of China at one point. They conquered Nepal, down into Bengal, over into Persia, they conquered. They were fierce. The only good thing about them, as far as their neighbors were concerned, was that they liked living at high altitude. So they only looted and pillaged and left. They didn't settle down, except on the Silk Route, where they settled down to get the wealth coming back and forth across the Silk Route. And they would have stayed in there for several centuries. So these are violent people. These are Rambo people. In 1,000 years, by the symbol of giving the authority over the country to the head monk, supposedly the living Jesus, incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the living Messiah, incarnation of that, means demilitarization. So this is why I say Tibet is the one culture, or one of two cultures actually, that became mainstream Buddhist cultures. In China, Korea, Japan, Sri Lanka, Thailand, wherever it is, you do have powerful monastic institutions at different times, and they do diminish the power of conquering kings and make the place more peaceful, but they're periodically pruned back by the kings, who get too broke, you know, too much land goes into this because people like that lifestyle. They like to learn from them. And then the kings take back manpower, they take back land and wealth, and then they have their army. So of the two institutions in what I call a countercultural Buddhist country, you have the monastic community and the monastic university and the Buddhist university, the Nalanda-type university, but you have still the main powers, the king and the army. So it's a dualistic social system. Only in Tibet did you get where the entire military was basically monasticized. And of course, everything human beings do is imperfect, and there were even some nasty monks going around beating people up, beating each other up. They would have monk Olympics, actually, and monk wrestling matches. They would. But they stopped invading their neighbors. They had no military. They survived without a military by diplomacy for 300 years, from that 350 years, until the communists, they wanted Mao to the dictatorship of the proletariat, they wanted the dictator to be the god, so they didn't want any religions, so they didn't respect the Tibetan role of this demilitarized, quite cheerful, actually, society. people with altruism as a kind of core value in the society. Although if a society was very imperfect, there were some bad people in it, of course, there was abuses. But by no means was it a feudal slave society like the Chinese propaganda says. That's absolutely false. If that were the case, as Mencius said to the Duke of Lu, whatever his country was, I think Lu, thousands of years ago, when the Duke said, it's a very bad government, the neighboring Duke is a really bad guy, his people hate his guts, I'm going to go over and liberate them from him. And Mencius, don't you think that's a good idea? And Mencius says, yes, Your Majesty, that could be a good idea. If you get to the border, and the people of the country come to the border, and they say, welcome, Duke King of Lu, come and get rid of our nasty king, we don't like him. And they march with you in there with their pitchforks, with your soldiers, and they kick out the king. It's a good idea. If they meet you at the border and they resist your invasion and they say, well, you don't like our king, and he may not be perfect, but he's our king, and we don't want you in our country, then it's a very bad idea. And the Tibetans valiantly tried to defend themselves against the overwhelming numbers of the Red Army. And they still do, actually, in their own way. Even though Dalai Lama called for nonviolence and whatever, let's work it out from the beginning. They did not, and they do not welcome them. They are not Chinese people. They don't want to be occupied. They don't want to be a colony of China. They do not. They never will. So which makes it a very dire situation indeed, still. But I believe personally Xi Jinping is going to fix it. But that's my personal strange belief. Nobody else has. I think His Holiness has that same belief. But I do. But I don't want to go into that right now. Anyway, what I'm saying, they did that. And then they did another thing to prove this against what we are all taught in school. Because we live in a country, totally militarized country. Look at the military budget of this country. And where the money is all going. And even the Republicans are not cutting that budget. Right? They're ready to cut welfare, schools, infrastructure, everything. But not that. So we live in such a culture and we're told we have to do that. Because that's natural to human beings. The human nature is such. If we don't have that, we'll be invaded and destroyed. But Tibet, and then who did Tibet convince of this, that this is this nonviolent lifestyle, and this educational lifestyle, and this evolutionary lifestyle, and this educational and self-conquest lifestyle is superior? The Mongolian people. Genghis Khan's descendants who had the larger empire than the British Empire, actually land mass, all of Russia, all of Persia. They even destroyed Baghdad before George Bush did. They destroyed it on previous time even without shock and awe. They did their own shock and awe there. And yet, 300 years of the Buddhist sciences showing them a superior way of being, and they abandoned their conquest. And they also became pushovers, like the Tibetans. And they survived for a few centuries in being pushovers. And in the 20th century, because of the spread of materialism, basically, the spread of the ideology, the destructive ideology of materialism, they were destroyed by Russian materialism. And Chinese, Inner-Mongolia Chinese materialism. The idea that everybody has to be a slave of material production. I don't care how idealistic communism might have been, that everybody shares everything. Dictatorship of the proletariat is just another form of emperorship. Stalin is another emperor, another czar, and now Putin wants to be one. And Mao was another emperor, that's all. And he wasn't even a nice emperor. He was like a silly one. Because at least the emperor had a national mass teachers, The emperors had Zen teachers often in China, Chan teachers they have. Some of them were Chan monks in their youth, and they were hiding from being poisoned in the harem. They would go and live in monasteries. So at least they had spiritual values alive in the country. But anyway, I don't want to put to that. I'm just saying that's what Tibet is. Now, after about 200 years of this top-down importation of Buddhism from Central Asia, from India, from Nepal, from Kashmir, from Bengal, these were different countries those days, even a little bit from China, Buddhism became kind of established in the people's minds, the Buddhist sciences, as a good thing. Not really so much as a religion. They kept, because Buddhism never tries to eradicate the native religion. And it didn't even try to eradicate the worship of the mountain or whatever it was. The only thing that Buddhism does eradicate in the native religion is animal sacrifice. And in a way, you could say that was that's what shows that actually Jesus was a similar psychonaut to the Buddhists. Because Jesus' whole symbolism, that he's the lamb, you know, and he's sacrificing himself, and, you know, don't bring and sacrifice the lamb, you know, that warded off this whole animal sacrifice routine that they were doing before. You know, he kicked them out while they were sacrificing pigeons, right? He kicked those people out of the temple. And he kind of reformed that aspect himself. He was against that. Because those enlightened people don't like the idea that you make a scapegoat out of some animal, and even God has to be a vegetarian, nonviolent. He doesn't need to eat some animal, you know. But anyway, God doesn't eat him anyway. The priests offer to the god, and then they barbecue it, they eat it themselves, and that's why they're overweight in the ancient days, you know, when they did animal sacrifice. So the one thing Buddhism doesn't like is animal sacrifice. And actually, even the Hindus, they think Buddha is God, you know, nowadays, the Vedist Hindus. And they say Buddha was the ninth avatar of Vishnu. And as the ninth avatar, he came and he saved animals and he stopped the Vedic sacrifices. You know, they actually say that. Even if they give Buddha that much credit for their vegetarianism. So they did that in Tibet as well. And where Buddhism became mainstream in Tibet, and through Tibet in Mongolia, there are many Mongolians, several Mongolians, the people became peaceful, basically. And they're still imperfect, and they're not all enlightened, and it wasn't Shangri-La, but it was a society that nurtured these universities. Imagine what America would be like if the Pentagon was a university rather than a military planning place, and that within, and the curriculum of that university included what, for example, Columbia and Harvard and all these things and Oxford and things did not include, even though Oxford and Cambridge, you know, that were monasteries before they were universities. The University of Bologna was a monastery first. So European universities grew out of, the University of Paris was the Paris Monastery. So the, you know, monks were the early faculty of these places because they were the learned people. And but now our secular thing, you know, the high priests of our universities are natural scientists, neuroscientists, psychologists, you know, and they do still do animal sacrifice. They slice up the monkeys and the mice and the thing. They really do it, and that's because they are the high priests. Because they are on the front. They're supposed to be on the advance of understanding reality. They're going to save us all with the best, the ultimate Prozac. There's going to be a Buddha Zack. The idea they would all be enlightened just by taking a pill, which we'll buy from Merck, is their fantasy. Or Novartis. That's their fantasy. I doubt it, personally. But I'm ready to swallow one. Just give it to me. Hell yes, if they manage. But I don't think so. For a scientific reason, I don't think so. So that was the mainstream. And then people will, even who are into how we have to all be armed to the teeth on this planet, they will point to Tibet and Mongolia even. They'll point to the Dalai Lama. Oh, he's nonviolent. How nice. But, you know, he's still subjugated after 60 years of Chinese invasion, since the Chinese invasion. And Tibet couldn't defend itself. They were crushed. And Mongolia couldn't defend itself. They once were Genghis Khan, Mongolia, were young Tibetans, and young Mongolians even think that. And in Mongolia, they have a big statue of Genghis Khan next to Buddha. Because Genghis was when they were contenders, you know, like Marlon. You know, we were contenders when we had Genghis. You know, we conquered the world. Now that we got conquered, all those Buddhists led us down the wrong path. So do you have them even thinking that? And the world basically thinks that. But I ask you, will the world survive another world war? Do you think? Do you think we'll manage that? Anybody think that? They're rebuilding some more nukes. You gotta go back to rebuilding nukes. That's the next step. Chinese have a lot of them. Putin's trying to build more again. Our Republicans want to, you know, George W. wanted to revamp for tactical nukes, he called. Small scale ones. Used in the battlefield. Even the uranium shell casing shells that they used in the first Gulf War that created all those malformed babies in southern Iraq, that it's hidden from the American people by our propagandized media. Even that's kind of nuclear warfare, you know, because it's penetrating, uranium hardened shell casing penetrates. And some genius who didn't know how to bury it in some salt mine in Utah, and somebody was doing NIMBY about it, and they couldn't have a storage for the old rods. They sold it to the munitions manufacturers and started making shell casings out of it, and then shoot it around other countries. And we've reached that demonic level, actually. And when a major war, there'll be cities will be flooded if emotional giants like Putin and W or Trump. Get a hold of the buttons. We're in deep. I mean, I believe there are angels who will prevent it personally, so don't get nervous, too nervous. But it's a fact that this lifestyle is not viable. And then the other side of that, and actually all that lifestyle is one of the three poisons. You learn the three poisons, right? Greed, hatred, lust, hate, and delusion, or ignorance. And the fundamental delusion, you know, which is that sense of I'm the one sort of attitude that people have, which can be projected into a religion. My religion is the one, my country is the one, my race is the one, my whatever is the one, my family, my clan, you know. But it starts with I'm the one. Right? So that's the delusion. And then the greed is consumerism. And the consumerism is, you know, creating this global, which I think more, I don't like warming expression. I like to call it global overheating. Because I think warming is too polite. It's much too dangerous. So global overheating, which is wrecking, threatening to wreck all of the planet, and create these, you know, nobody knows. Syria is Assad's fault, yes. He's a complete bastard like his father was. He'll kill 100,000 people, doesn't matter, as long as he keeps his power, his chair. You know. But before he did that, there was a 5-year drought in Syria, which is unprecedented in recorded history. And therefore, people were abandoning their farms and moving into Damascus, and it was like infrastructural chaos already before he started killing people in the streets, which of course then precipitated this. But the climate thing had a huge impact on all of that, Arab Spring, and especially Syria. But that people don't hide that in our thing because the oil industry won't buy commercials on networks that make a big fuss about the effect of climate change already hitting us. So anyway, these two countries, Tibet and Mongolia, these two cultures, these two civilizational streams are where this Buddhist culture went mainstream. And it went mainstream in people who were very able warriors and they could conquer. They were really intensely conquering. And they were really tough and people. And yet they decided that it wasn't worth it and better be vulnerable and have a happy life. And feel the bliss from within by getting rid of the emotional plague, what Wilhelm Reich rightly called the emotional plague, the militarized, like even neural structure, you know, where you don't feel, you know, because you're, and then you know, you don't feel, so you can be harsh with others and domineer them and kill them and do this and live like that. And it's not worth living like that, it's where the decision comes. They know they might be conquered back by somebody, but they were pretty protected in their step, the great step of the Mongolians. Oh, they would sometimes fight with each other, but and then the Tibetans high in their high altitude, they were sort of a little bit, you know, geologically connected, protected. So they lasted a long time without a military. And then all that money in the military, imagine if for the Pentagon, these, you know, $1 trillion, it's not just so many, 700 billion, that's just immediate budget, is trillions of dollars invested in it. And that, you know, all the industries that make all the stuff, and it's a huge thing. And if that money was invested in art, in education, and, you know, people were valuing self-control in people rather than dominating ability, if the yoga of our universities was not soccer, football, lacrosse, but was actual yoga and meditation, what kind of country would we have? We'd be happy people. We'd really be jolly. Everyone would be jolly. Nobody would look worried and feel nervous, right? And there'd be no Rambo would be like, he'd be in the deep meditation there. And then he'd jump up and bang his own head for a while. And then sit back down and meditate. You know, he would not be like slitting everybody's throats. You know? So maybe the predator would arrive from outer space. It's a hard time. But the point is, as I say in one of my books, Why the Dalai Lama Matters, if you really learn the Buddhist sciences, you know, you're doing Nalanda program, you're doing some version of this curriculum that should be the curriculum of all our universities and high schools and things. In other words, our schools should be based on the fact that education is the purpose of human life. We're here to learn. Education is not to fit you for a slave job somewhere, earning a wage and trying to save for a pension and hoping that some corporate raider doesn't trash your pension fund before you get to old age. You're here, your purpose on life is to learn, to expand your being, your sense of awareness and being, your understanding of everything, and find the inner bliss that is your birthright as a human being. That is the purpose of life, actually. And if you don't do that, and if you die dragged by unconscious impulses, Eros, Thanatos, and I found out there's a deity for the ignorance and delusion, Ate is the delusion deity. So Freud didn't have Ate, right? Because he only had Eros and Thanatos, you know, for the three poisons, and he didn't have Ate. But Ate, and unfortunately, because chauvinist Greeks, it's female, you know. They're blaming some female. Typical. You know. But Ate is apparently the goddess of ignorance or confusion or whatever. You know. Ate. If you're dragged by those subconscious drives and unexamined impulses, then your rebirth is not guaranteed. You don't know, because you'll be attracted to things maybe where you won't like where you land, attracted where you land. You won't really like it where you go. You have to have a sense of free space. You know, that mindfulness business is really valuable. And not to make you a better corporate, whatever it is. Actually, the corporations are having a romance with mindfulness nowadays because it lessens sick days and it makes people this and that, the other and the other. But actually, if they keep at it, people also start to question the mission of the corporation. So then they'll kind of like, there'll be a backlash about it. Like those people from the contemplative science group that had a seminar in the 90s, or I think maybe the early noughts, with 25 vice presidents at Monsanto. And then after the two-week thing, 15 out of 25 resigned from Monsanto. So Monsanto has not had a second one of those, I'm sure. No, because they realized they were poisoning people, you know, and they're Roundup and all this crap. And hiding that by corrupt government. Anyway, so this is the thing. I just want to read you this one thing. I love it, but I can't find it. Where is Samantabhadra? Where is he? And we almost had it. So that's Tibet. You know, that's the Nalanda curriculum. And we should graduate people. They get a bachelor degree. I'm not sure why they call it bachelor. I think they often get married after they graduate. But the bachelor degree should be a person who has true self-control, who has, I think, what do you like? Joe likes the phrase self-regulation, which I think is a very good one. And they are able to restrain those kind of impulses. They're able to make a conscious choice among impulses. They're not necessarily suppressing their deeper energies, but they're able to choose how to express it. They're capable of sublimating it. They're not just driven. And here's, for example, Diamond Matrix in the 10-stage sutra. Contemplating with immeasurably powerful intellect, with very subtle knowledge, atom-splitting knowledge, thus entering into the abode of the secret of Buddhas, they reach the 9th stage, benefactors of the world. This is thousands of years old, by the way, before nuclear power. Their mental command and concentration are great. Their far-reaching mystic knowledge, he uses that, I wouldn't use mystic, I would say spiritual knowledge enters all lands. With certainty of knowledge and power, this is the abode of the steadfastness of the victors, the self-conquerors. The wise, with commitment and compassion, enter this 9th stage. Those who have reached this stage, holders of Buddha's treasury, know what is good, what is bad, and what is neutral, what is tainted and worldly, and what is transcendent. what is conceivable and what is inconceivable. They examine what is certain and what is uncertain and foster the practices accomplishing the three vehicles. Teachings of the stages according to inclinations and conduct, they prepare and enter the world accordingly. With superior subtle intellect following such knowledge, they search out the mental tangles of sentient beings. They search out the various tangles of mind and comprehend who can be taught what the end and the beginning are. They comprehend beginningless afflictions in their interrelatedness of application, as well as the continuity of their courses through compulsive propensities, and in terms of the various differences in process of action and the vanishing of effect with extinction of cause. They comprehend which faculties are weak, middling, and strong, and continuity between past and future, inclinations of various kinds, and whether or not they are pure. They comprehend all 84,000 teachings. Worldly beings are developed into different dispositions, gone into the tangles of afflictions and views, beginningless, endless, never cut off, continually bound up with the mind, born together with and stuck to inclinations and propensities. Those inclinations and propensities are not real things. They have no location and are not apart from mind. Hard to know, unconquerable by the states of meditation. They can be cut off only by the diamond thunderbolt of the path. The diamond thunderbolt is critical wisdom. Entering the varieties of six courses of migration of life, you know, animal, preta, hell, human, titan, and deity. Those are the six courses. Craving being the moisture, ignorance the shade, action the field, consciousness the seeds, name and form the simultaneous sprouts. Thus do they see beings in the world beginningless and endless. Those beings' minds are full of the action of afflictions according to patterns of habit. Apart from this, they have no desire for further continuation of transmigration. The enlightening beings do not. They don't need to be reborn in regular bodies themselves. They're in bliss completely with or without a body. They know how to die. They have died happily, and they can be reborn happily without breaking their bliss of beyond body, and they can embody non-dually either. So life and death are the same to them in a way. Who are some confused and who are those with knowledge? With these reflections stationed in this stage, enlightening beings reveal the teaching in different ways according to people's dispositions, faculties, and inclinations, versed in analytic knowledge, meanings, elocution, and expression. They are in the position of preachers of the teaching, you know, teachers of the teaching, why is it put preachers? Like lions, like bulls, like majestic mountains, they shower the sweet rain of the elixir of immortality, just as water spirits fill the sea. Skilled in seeking out meanings as well as the essence of things, comprehending all expressions, they have mastered elocution. Having attained countless millions of decades of concentration spells, they hold the teachings as the ocean holds the rain. Thus, having attained concentration by purification through spells, they see thousands of Buddhas in one instant. And having gained the treasure of the teaching, they expound it, reaching in each and every sphere with its purifying sound. They set the various beings of the billion worlds free by means of the three treasures, satisfying all according to their faculties and dispositions, like water spirits filling the ocean. With even greater virtue, they exert their energy and think how there are in a minute point unthinkable numbers of Buddha's teaching, and in every subatomic point there are innumerable numbers of Buddha's teaching. You know, the modern physicists are wondering what there are inside black holes. Well, there are billions of Buddhas in there and other universes in there according to this ancient teaching thousands of years ago. And this is now translated from Chinese, which was translated from Sanskrit, and which is at least 2,000 years old. Hearing the teachings, they hold them as the earth holds seeds. As many beings as there are in the 10 directions, all that's, you know, in every direction, all sit in a single circle of assembly, appearing to them all in a single instant, enlightening beings will satisfy them all with a single utterance. Stationed here, masters of the teaching, highest of humans and gods, they become children of Buddhas, moving by the teachings day and night. They are in the company of the Buddhas, established in profound tranquility, firm in knowledge and liberation. They attend millions of Buddhas and become purified like the adornments of a monarch. Their light overcomes the obscurities of afflictions like the light of Brahma. That's the creator, you know, who the non-Buddhists think is the creator. But he is a very powerful god. He's a big backer of the Buddha, illuminating a million worlds. In this stage, they become Brahma gods, imbued with virtue and satisfied beings with the teaching of the three vehicles. What they undertake is for the benefit of all beings. Following enlightened knowledge, they attain virtue and knowledge. In a single instant, they attain as many concentrations as atoms in innumerable lands, steadfast. Seeing the Buddhas of the ten directions, they hear the teaching, and beyond that, by willpower, they work innumerable miracles. So that's just a typical thing. That's the ninth stage of the Bodhisattva. But that was what I wanted to read to you. But it's a good one.
Should we take a few questions, Bob? We have a few more minutes.
Sure, I ask for questions anytime.
Anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Yes. What?
My question was about the Dalai Lama recently. I don't know how, perhaps he's been talking about it longer.
Yeah.
Not incarnating, obviously because of the fear.
Oh, that's a misunderstanding.
Yeah, if you could explain that.
Having to do with the Chinese, preposterously as Marxist materialists, supposedly, although really, they're all actually into Buddhism. When some into, there's about 100 million Catholics, 150 million Muslims, 600-700 million Buddhists, and who knows, some Taoists. You know, but in classical China, they didn't make a big fight between Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism from the Ming Dynasty on. The Song Dynasty, they had a little bit of Confucian anti-Buddhism. But basically, they don't make that difference. But the Chinese are so nervous because of the popularity of Buddhism and of the Dalai Lama, amongst their own people, even, that they're like, we're going to have the next Dalai Lama. We're going to appoint him. We're gonna do this. So then the Dalai Lama says, there isn't going to be a next Dalai Lama. Meaning, and he's written a constitution like that over many years, and he's finally signed off on the final form of it about 5 years ago, where there will be no political role for any future Lama of any kind. It'll be a fully elected parliament and presidency, prime minister, I think more like Indian government, Indian system than American. And but I think president and prime minister, so I think like India. And he will not occupy that as a Lama. And he will be reborn in his monastery, which is the big monastic university, the sort of Nalanda of the present day in Tibet, which still exists with its full curriculum with about 4,000 monks in South India. And their one in Tibet is pretty shut down, and they have to read the little red book, and they are like persecuted quite a bit, and they're not. So he only says there will be no Dalai Lama, meaning the 360-some years of the Dalai Lama government, which his previous incarnations and himself managed, you know, they supervised, but they were usually had regents and things. They were just, in a way, symbolic figureheads mostly. Occasionally they were hands-on, and he had been, of course, in exile, had to be very hands-on. 13th was also quite hands-on because his predecessor, because they were invaded by the British, and he had to go to Mongolia and China, and then even to the British in India, back and forth, and he got to see the situation in the modern world, and tried to make a flag and an anthem and a post office and a coinage and do all the things that for nationhood, and tried to apply to the League of Nations, but was prevented by the British from doing so, because they were already, you know, executing the sellout of Tibet to whatever Chinese people were there to do business with China. The Hong Kong British were already in the 19th century. So when he says that, he's just saying that he's not going to be in a political role, so they need not worry about appointing him. And, you know, he will be appointed by spiritual means, you know, by thing, by committee that will find him spiritually. And he will be resident in his monastery as a monk, and not as a governor of any kind. So that's what that means. Avalokiteshvara cannot stop incarnating. You know, his vow is to incarnate as long as there are beings who are suffering anywhere in the universe. It's like an infinite messianic vow.
And that's what I was thinking when I was doing the reading.
I'm sorry?
That's exactly what I was thinking when I was doing the reading. It was my misunderstanding about
yes.
it. And the reading was saying that.
Right. And like that, Karmapa is also incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, and there are many. And then there are a lot of female Avalokiteshvaras, and Taras, there's a zillion Taras. There's 21 major forms of Tara, but there's like endless Tara, you know, female Buddhas. Here's green, and this is green Tara, yeah. The green one is particularly dynamic. She has 1 foot down like that, indicating that she's ready to come. And she was so popular in India. There are, if you go to Patna Museum or Calcutta Museum, especially even Delhi Museum or Bombay, Mumbai Museum, there are these black stones, especially from Pala Dynasty and Gupta Dynasty, Tara, with eight scenes of sort of catastrophes, like someone's being trampled by, attacked by elephants, by lions, by tigers, by snakes, by flood, by forest fire, by, I think, by hurricanes, and by kings, put in prison by unjustly by kings, bad kings. And, you know, that's called the eight dangers, or the eight catastrophes. And you just say, Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Swaha, and she comes and opens the prison, and she gets rid of the tigers, and she chases away the elephants, etc. They believe that, and they have that sculpture for her. And hundreds of them, thousands of them. And so she was like, it's like the Virgin Mary or something in India and Tibet. And then in so much so that in China, even Avalokiteshvara, on the popular level, is thought of as female, Kuan Yin. Although they know that also there's male forms of Kuan Yin, of Avalokiteshvara.